Welcome to the weekly Medicast Roundup from Personalized Intelligence. We're here to distill the noise, cut through the headlines, and give you a strategic overview of the week that was.
Worth noting, think of it as taking a step back from the individual trees to see the shape of the forest, a forest that's growing remarkably and sometimes alarmingly fast. This week, April 6, 11, 2026, presented a particularly concentrated burst of critical shifts.
Shifts is putting it mildly. We saw a week where simmering tensions boiled over, old power structures were actively challenged, and the future, frankly, felt less predictable than ever.
It's a moment that demands a broader perspective. Like training a falcon, you can't just focus on the immediate lure. You need to read the wind, anticipate the bird's path, and understand the landscape to truly control the flight. And right now, the geopolitical landscape is in a state of rapid reorientation.
Let's dive in. We'll begin with Iran's strategic monetization of the Strait of Hormuz. The recent ceasefire isn't about establishing lasting peace, but a calculated move to leverage control of that vital waterway.
From there, we'll unpack the accelerating erosion of U.S. financial system control, specifically through the expanding role of cryptocurrency and its use in asymmetrical warfare. The conflict isn't solely about oil anymore. It's evolving into a full-blown financial crisis.
We'll then move to the truly unsettling pace of AI development and how that's outpacing our ability to secure it, creating a new arms race and exposing systemic vulnerabilities.
And of course, we'll examine Trump's increasingly transactional foreign policy, which is essentially redefining geopolitical leverage as we know it.
Finally, we'll close with a look at the emergence of a machine economy, powered by agentic AI, and the urgent need to reevaluate our financial risk models. Let's start with the Strait of Hormuz and Iran's play. Ed Finley Richardson called it a messy normalization. Doesn't exactly inspire confidence, does it?
It's a surprisingly accurate description, actually. Tanker rates aren't soaring because oil supply is constricted, but because of deliberate inefficiencies around the Strait of Hormuz. Higher value from a partially open strait than a fully open one, it reframes the equation entirely, maximizing utilization and profits through congestion. It's a bullish outcome for the industry, though not in the way most people assume.
Bullish for tanker owners, maybe. So Iran isn't trying to block trade, they're trying to toll it.
Stepping back, Sincor's accumulation of 30 to 35% of the VLCC market, up from just 30 ships 2 years ago, is the clearest signal of this shift. That's not cornering the market, that's a demonstration of force. He's intentionally withholding capacity to impact pricing dynamics, and the market is responding.
And even China's playing along. I thought they'd be screaming.
They are screaming quietly. But even China faces genuine risks navigating the Gulf safely. Iran's leverage is unexpectedly potent. They aren't necessarily maximizing their own export volume, but they've created a critical pressure point by disrupting shipping, and that's enough.
Okay, so how are they collecting these tolls? Carrier pigeons.
USDT.
They're collecting in Tether. $3 billion is projected to move through crypto in 2025 alone. This is the unsettling part. The US dollar, the foundation of global finance, facilitating adversarial actions.
Wait, so the sanctions, they're being bypassed using our currency. That feels absurd.
Paradoxical, yes. It introduces concerns about oversight and potential seizure strategies, undermining the entire regime. Iran could generate $4.6 billion from a one-time toll on the 2,000 to 3,000 vessels currently stranded. That's rivaling or exceeding the annual revenues of the Panama and Suez canals.
So this ceasefire isn't a step toward peace. It's a step toward revenue.
Jared Melson pointed out a pattern. Iran's negotiation tactics during the 2015 JCPOA deal, repeatedly reopening settled issues to gain leverage. This feels like a replay. The sudden insistence on controlling the Strait of Hormuz was an issue not previously on the table, and the conflict served as a pressure test.
Pressure test that somehow resulted in them getting what they wanted.
Essentially, the localized tolling system, even if managed by Iran, is now the best-case scenario, restoring a degree of certainty Washington can no longer guarantee. The market fails to recognize this isn't about restoring the status quo, but accepting a new one where maritime stability requires direct payment to Tehran.
A protection racket, basically. But who benefits from this mess? Because someone always benefits.
The U.S., surprisingly. Robert Armstrong predicts we'll be the big winner in financial markets this year, and it stems from our energy independence and relative economic resilience. We're a net oil exporter, less sensitive to inflation.
I did not see that coming.
It's a matter of structural positioning. Russia and China's veto of the UN resolution is telling, though. It's not just about supporting Iran.
It's about protecting their own choke points. Taiwan, the South China Sea.
The data tells a story, it establishes a precedent. If the Hormuz situation can be used against them regarding Taiwan and other strategic locations in East Asia, they're going to prevent any international intervention.
So power shift in the Middle East, dollar facilitating sanctions evasion, U.S. benefiting, what about fertilizer?
That's where the real vulnerability lies. Energy price declines mask a critical issue. Global fertilizer reserves represent less than 30 days of caloric supply. That decisively alters the risk profile.
Less than 30 days? Seriously?
Seriously?
Recent energy price declines aren't broadly disinflationary. They're masking a potential food price surge. Portfolio managers betting on continued deflation and governments planning based on that model now face systemic risk.
Panic buying in Asia already defies logic, right?
Defies it.
The tanker rate surge isn't a rational response to supply constraints. It's panicked Asian demand. It exposes strategies anticipating a smooth Venezuela template reentry of Iranian oil.
And the interceptors for Ukraine?
The diversion of interceptor supplies initially allocated to Ukraine due to Iran's drone sophistication further illustrates instability. They're rapidly increasing in both technology and tactical expertise since 2022, and U.S. radar systems weren't prepared for those advances.
Okay, so Saudi Arabia's curtailed oil export capacity, the USD stablecoin payment scheme, and fertilizer reserves barely covering a month of caloric demand. It's a cascading series of vulnerabilities.
It is.
Saudi Arabia's capacity reduction establishes a structurally higher oil price baseline. Bond markets have priced the shock, the two-year treasury remaining above 3.8%, making a return to pre-conflict interest rate expectations untenable. But the biggest shift is the recognition that control of strategic choke points is an explicit and monetizable asset. Within 18 months, a sovereign wealth fund partially financed by Strait of Hormuz transit fees is likely to be publicly announced.
That's wild. The whole system is recalibrating. It's like the Earth's crust shifting after a major tectonic event, and everyone's building on unstable foundations. The one thing that keeps me up at night is this: everyone is treating this like a regional problem, but this isn't about oil or shipping or even Iran. It's about the implicit acceptance of a new economic order, one where critical infrastructure can be held hostage for profit. And nobody seems to have a plan for when the next player decides to leverage their control. You know what I noticed this week? Everyone's still talking about how safe US treasuries are. Like they're the default setting for panic, right? But the 10-year is pushing 4.25% despite everything going on in the Middle East. Feels off.
It is off. The conventional wisdom is that geopolitical instability drives capital into U.S. debt, assuming it's a safe haven. The current surge suggests that appetite for U.S. debt as a guaranteed store of value is diminishing, even in the face of conflict. This isn't simply about oil supply disruptions. It's a fundamental reassessment of risk perception.
Reassessment is a polite word. Is someone actively not wanting to hold our IOUs? And if so, why now?
The someone isn't a single entity, but a cascading set of events exposing the vulnerability of the entire financial system. We're seeing a convergence of factors beginning with a shift in attack vectors targeting the DeFi space, specifically exploiting operational security or OPSEC failures, not code itself. The Drift Protocol hack is a perfect example.
$285 million lost, right? But wasn't that social engineering? Like someone tricked an admin into giving up a key. Sounds less like a hack and more like really bad password hygiene.
So here's the picture. It wasn't a smart contract flaw, but a 6-month-plus intelligence operation targeting a specific admin key through classic Web2 social engineering tactics and market manipulation. The crucial point is this is no longer opportunistic. DPRK-affiliated hackers are building trust with crypto engineers over extended periods, blending legitimate business development with malicious intent. This broadening of the attack surface means traditional audits are increasingly ineffective.
So audits are theater?
Largely, yes. Michael Llewellyn, a former auditor, observed that the tight overlap between legitimate activity and malicious infiltration makes differentiation nearly impossible. The largest hacks aren't about code, they're about people. They're about exploiting weaknesses in human decision-making, not finding bugs in the system.
That's terrifying. Are these hackers working alone, or is there like a hierarchy? I'm picturing a little North Korean office park overflowing with laptops.
There's a clear hierarchical structure. This fundamentally alters negotiation strategies. Unlike dealing with a single DeFi hacker, recovery requires navigating an internal approval process, making successful fund return far less likely. Amanda Wick parallels it to pig butchering schemes, suggesting the potential for unwitting individuals extending operations geographically and the disturbing possibility of human trafficking.
Pig butchering. That's colorful but deeply unsettling. So it's not just technical prowess, it's organized crime with proxies.
Something to flag here, they're strategic about it. The attackers deliberately chose USDC over USDT in the Drift hack.
Why?
Because of its higher liquidity and the predictably slow freezing mechanisms implemented by Circle. They know Circle's response time and they're exploiting it.
Wait, so our stablecoins are attractive to hackers? That's not exactly a good selling point.
It's worse. The usability of USDC actively attracts attacks, transforming it into a magnet for increasingly sophisticated breaches. DeFi protocols implicitly trust centralized stablecoin issuers, trusting they won't disrupt operations. Circle hasn't reciprocated this trust by prioritizing proactive user fund protection. It's a single point of failure, and the entire DeFi ecosystem is dependent on it.
Okay, that's officially a nightmare scenario. And it's not even about the code anymore, it's about trusting a company to not get hacked.
And the geopolitical implications are profound. Rand's use of USDT to bypass sanctions demonstrates this reality. Currently, $3 billion in crypto transactions are leveraging these systems to circumvent established financial channels. This directly threatens the Fed's cheap source of funding, their currency franchise.
Cheap source of funding. Nice euphemism for control of the global economy.
It is.
Chris Perkins predicts a forthcoming surge in stablecoin adoption, potentially reaching $127 trillion in tokenized equities, far exceeding the Treasury's $3 trillion estimate. This creates a critical security challenge that will necessitate proactive government response.
Okay, so everyone is looking at the code, and nobody is worried about the humans running the system, and Iran is happily skipping past all of our financial regulations. What's traditional finance doing about all this? Aside from panicking and buying gold, presumably.
Franklin Templeton's acquisition of 250 Digital is a key indicator. It's not solely an investment in crypto strategies, but a strategic move to leverage a regulated 40 Act money market fund, already the second largest tokenized fund after ARCA, as a functional stablecoin. It's bringing traditional finance onto the blockchain, leveraging existing regulatory frameworks.
So, a regulated stablecoin to compete with DeFi. I'm sensing a power move.
However, institutions remain risk-averse. Interactive brokers pass suppression of prediction markets, prioritizing regulatory approval over innovation demonstrates this pattern. The SEC is now actively fostering open dialogue with the industry, signaling a shift towards collaboration, but it's a delicate balance.
A very slow and cautious dance, then. Okay, so people are being hacked, stablecoins are becoming magnets for attacks, Iran is bypassing sanctions, and the Fed is losing control, and traditional finance is tiptoeing onto the blockchain. Back to treasuries, that 4.25% yield.
It signals diminished appetite for U.S. debt as a safe haven. This challenges the assumption that recessionary fears alone will continue to drive capital into high-quality bonds. The convergence of exploited operational security, sophisticated nation-state actors, and stablecoin vulnerabilities reveals a fundamental shift in the control of the U.S. financial system.
So the safety of U.S. treasuries isn't guaranteed anymore.
There's a signal here, the most significant threat isn't code flaws, but the potential for adversarial nations to functionally bypass the global reserve currency through a targeted network of digital assets before the end of the decade.
The entire system is built on a series of increasingly fragile trust assumptions, and someone is actively poking holes in it. Ultimately, the largest recent hacks aren't about code vulnerabilities, they're about leveraging human trust to access systemic choke points, which is creating a future where geopolitical adversaries effectively bypass the dollar, undermining the Fed's control and shifting the global financial power dynamic. Josh Hawley thinks startups are basically reinventing company building with AI teams. Is that hyperbole?
It's not an exaggeration. Agentic teams are enabling an unprecedented speed of scaling, but that's widening a critical gap. Larger enterprises burdened by existing infrastructure, what Hawley calls existential state, can't move at the same velocity, and we're seeing that play out in venture capital dynamics right now. Tiny companies are achieving massive scale very quickly, which is disruptive to say the least.
Gina Raimondo says U.S. companies are optimizing for short-term shareholder value, even if it undermines stability. Every incentive says your job is to maximize short-term share price. So is it fair to blame them when efficiency leads to layoffs?
That's the core of the mismatch. We've accepted a very narrow definition of success, and it creates a perverse incentive structure. Raimondo's point is that prioritizing immediate financial gains overrides long-term considerations, and that's directly impacting secure development practices. Rapid scaling becomes the priority, inevitably creating vulnerabilities.
Balaji Srinivasan calls it being scalar. Companies are focused on disruption but aren't accounting for simultaneous shifts in what exactly?
Political singularities, unexpected systemic shifts in geopolitical leverage. He's arguing Silicon Valley companies optimize for growth without adequately preparing for truly black swan events. It creates a blind spot around systemic risk and fosters overconfidence in predictive models.
90% jailbreak rates. That sounds bad.
Labelbox's research demonstrates that current public safety benchmarks for large language models are deeply misleading. They rely on prompts that simply don't reflect the tactics malicious actors would employ. Naive tests show a few percent failure rate, but adversarial prompts designed to mimic real-world attacks bypass those safeguards 90% of the time. That's a critical vulnerability gap we're overlooking.
Anthropic's mythos sounds like science fiction. A country of geniuses in a data center. Harlan Stewart thinks it could militarily dominate the world in 12 months. Seriously?
The ambition is certainly audacious. Stewart's phrasing is extreme, but the underlying capability is what's concerning. Mythos is already exploiting zero-day vulnerabilities, discovering flaws in codebases decades old, a 27-year-old bug in OpenBSD, a 16-year-old bug in FFmpeg. These aren't the result of deliberate hacking training. They're a consequence of improved code reasoning and autonomy.
So it's just understanding the code too well.
It identifies vulnerabilities simply by examining code, not through active penetration testing. Anthropic's limited release isn't solely about cybersecurity. It's likely a strategic maneuver to manage compute constraints and capitalize on high-paying enterprise demand. Jayan, formerly of Replit Now, argues the cybersecurity scare provides a convenient justification for prioritizing exclusive access.
What does 92% on terminal bench tasks even mean?
It means prior benchmarking is almost meaningless. The scale of Mythos's capability jump, exceeding previous advancements, fundamentally changes the landscape. We've reached a point where the testing harnesses themselves are inadequate. It's the biggest step change since GPT-4, and Anthropic's own internal testing revealed those limitations.
Okay, so AI is getting smarter, faster, and DevOps is becoming irrelevant. Austin Griffith stopped using it because it's better at his job.
That's the critical erosion of specialized expertise. ZAI's GLM 5.1 is demonstrating an unprecedented advance in autonomous work time, leaping from 20 steps to 1,700 achievable by agents. The implication is clear: AI isn't just automating tasks, it's replacing specialized human labor. This forces a move from reactive patching to preemptive anticipation of sophisticated attacks.
Kyne Warwick thinks we should assume every hack is a Mythos probe. That's paranoid.
Maybe.
But it reframes the risk assessment. If these systems are capable of systematically exploiting codebases, we need to consider the possibility that recent incidents weren't coincidental. Assessing vulnerabilities requires anticipating a level of autonomy and sophistication we haven't encountered before.
LNG shortages. Seriously, how does that affect AI?
It's a systemic constraint on data center expansion. Qatar's liquefaction train rebuilds are taking 3 to 5 years, limiting the availability of energy necessary to power these systems. Venture capitalists funding hyperscale projects are facing unexpectedly high operating costs, potentially negating projected gains and aligning agent economy expenses with human labor rates. It's a critical, overlooked dependency.
Philanthropic investing, deal-making, increased returns, I'm lost.
Promote Giving's rapid growth stems from its value as a forum for aligned general partners. The network incentivizes participation by facilitating partnerships and building trust, increasing investment performance across the board. We've seen the assumption that philanthropic investing necessitates a trade-off between returns and impact exposed.
Iranian drones exposing U.S. radar weaknesses and diverting interceptor supplies to Ukraine. That feels like more than just an AI problem.
It is, but AI is accelerating the dynamic. Iran's rapidly increasing sophistication, driven by technology and tactical knowledge gained from Russia since 2022, is exposing critical vulnerabilities in our defenses. And it's having real-world consequences, forcing the diversion of resources intended for Ukraine.
Customized intelligence systems in finance, automated trading loops, market volatility, it's all feeding back on itself.
Two things stand out. The doubling in revenue at a leading AI search platform confirms accelerating demand for customized intelligence systems. Individuals are building applications capable of identifying market vulnerabilities, creating feedback loops where automated trading exacerbates volatility.
The rise of Delve correlating with large language models. You're telling me the tools are changing how we think.
That's the deeper transformation underway. It suggests these tools are not only changing what language is used, but also how it is formed. Algorithmic output is increasingly defining linguistic reality. It's a subtle but fundamental reshaping of our cognitive landscape.
Anthropic's limited release, 12 partners, $100 million in credits, acknowledges that the model's capabilities exceed current containment strategies. Is that terrifying?
It is a sober assessment of the risks. That cautious approach implies Mythos possesses vulnerabilities or potential for misuse that warrant extreme containment measures. The next 12 months will reveal the limits of control over a country of geniuses in a data center. The current configuration of incentives, short-term shareholder value, compute scarcity, and venture capital concentration prioritizes deployment of increasingly powerful AI systems over comprehensive security assessments.
So we've got speed, compute constraints, geopolitical blind spots, and a rapidly changing language. But what's the core question this whole conversation didn't answer?
Honestly, whether we can reliably attribute observed behavior, like the hacks Kyne Warwick mentioned, to these systems, or if we're already projecting our fears onto a complex, opaque reality. We don't fully understand the causality.
Okay, because if you start conflating exploratory probes with deliberate attacks, the entire paradigm shifts, and the incentives for nation-state actors to fundamentally redefine geopolitical leverage become very clear. So apparently China is now preemptively censoring things people might say. Like they're anticipating coded language. May 34th instead of June 4th. It's thorough.
It's beyond thorough, Maya. It's a fundamental shift in control. We've always understood their domestic censorship apparatus, but this signals a proactive capacity, a predictive policing of information. The implication is their systems are evolving faster than our comprehension, and increasingly, they're offering that capability as a service.
A service? Like a digital security package. Remove dissent starting at $99 a month.
Effectively, it's being pushed through the Digital Silk Road Initiative, offering infrastructure, surveillance technology, and the expertise to operate it. The assumption that China's digital advancements were contained domestically is becoming dangerously obsolete. And it links directly to their energy security priorities.
Right, because the G7 meltdown over Libra in 2019 wasn't really about Libra, was it?
It's a telling detail. It wasn't an economic concern. It was a display of long-simmering resentment towards the dollar's exorbitant privilege. A deeply personal reaction, almost nationalistic. This explains the disproportionate response and the underlying vulnerability of the U.S. in maintaining its financial hegemony. Countries like Canada are pragmatically reassessing their positions, seeing instability in American foreign policy.
Shapiro called that the biggest geopolitical story of the year before the Iran situation. Something about Mark Carney taking the sign out of the window at Davos.
That's correct. Carney signaling a shift in investor confidence. The underlying dynamic is that the U.S. has been prioritizing short-term economic gains and squeezing geopolitical leverage, which, while beneficial in the moment, breeds uncertainty and invites alternative power structures. China is quietly preparing for that disruption, investing heavily in renewables, framing it not as an economic play but as existential self-preservation.
Existential self-preservation. Over oil.
It's not just over oil. It's about creating a resilient system. The whole Iran episode highlights that perfectly. Trump's approach wasn't about achieving concrete results, it was about creating a perception of influence. A ceasefire could have been reached weeks earlier, but prioritizing appearances undermined substantive progress.
The TACO acronym. Back down from threats. Seriously?
It's an internal description of his decision-making process. And that forced Pakistan's Prime Minister Sharif to publicly plead for a 2-week pause. That signal fundamentally altered the dynamic, providing Trump with the off-ramp he needed. It reveals a critical vulnerability, a dependence on external actors to manufacture face-saving measures.
He needed someone to tell him how to de-escalate.
More than that, Field Marshal Asim Munir, his favorite field marshal, personally facilitated the talks. That's not conventional diplomacy, it's reliance on personal rapport and informal channels. And the surge in exposés about the lead-up to the war, with Vance as a key dissenter, was likely a deliberate leak campaign to protect Vance's presidential prospects.
A dam-breaking Bimon called it. From Maggie Haberman and Jonathan Swan's forthcoming book.
The pattern is clear: coordinated narrative control. Trump viewed every international situation as an opportunity for personal gain, to squeeze countries. As Walt describes him, a predatory hegemon. But it's inadvertently aiding China.
Because the world looks unstable under Trump and China looks predictable.
The implication runs deeper, a pragmatic choice for many nations. And this returns to the digital censorship. China's internal capabilities are being exported. They're anticipating coded language, including him to refer to Xi Jinping, suggesting far more sophisticated control mechanisms than previously understood. The assumption of containment is exposed. We're seeing, in real time, the normalization of authoritarian practices.
A ceasefire, fragile as it is, isn't a resolution. It's a calculated pause, a reassessment of leverage. And markets, predictably, are underestimating the implications of a world where geopolitical influence is measured not in alliances, but in personal connections and the ability to create chaos on demand. What happens when that infrastructure, that censorship capability, is widely deployed?
That's the core uncertainty. We don't know how extensively these systems will be adopted or how effective resistance will be. But the precedent is being set. and the speed at which China is advancing, anticipating dissent before it's even vocalized, is profoundly disturbing. It's a quiet reshaping of the information landscape, and that's a far more insidious threat than any conventional military conflict.
34. 97,000%. That's Anthropic's annualized revenue growth. Is that a sustainable rate, or are we just rewriting the rules of profitability one GPU at a time?
It's rewriting them definitively. OpenAI and Anthropic are effectively disaggregating profitability calculations, excluding training and inference costs. Think of an airline excluding jet replacement costs. It looks profitable until you realize the fundamental capital outlay isn't accounted for. This structure signals an eventual reliance on public markets to finance continued expansion, especially given the hyperscale demands of these models.
The AI boom is a beautifully disguised IPO pipeline fueled by LNG.
We can trace that further. The demand for computational power has exposed a critical vulnerability in the energy market. Qatar's LNG outages, with liquefaction train rebuild spanning 3 to 5 years, are now bottlenecking data center expansion, directly impacting AI model scalability. This means the cost of AI computation is aligning more closely with the price of human labor, a constraint venture capitalists are unexpectedly encountering when funding these projects.
Unexpectedly. It seems incredibly obvious.
The scale of the constraint is the surprise. It's ironically diversifying investment into less correlated markets. Investors are seeking returns independent of traditional tech and commodity assets, recognizing that AI's growth isn't a rising tide lifting all boats. Gresham Quantum, for example, is highlighting European carbon despite its initial negative Sharpe ratio, acknowledging its inherent trend potential. They're prioritizing structural drivers decoupled from mainstream dynamics.
Structural drivers, or desperation for something that isn't correlated with everything else?
Both likely. But this search for uncorrelated assets reveals a deeper disconnect between quantitative modeling and real-world performance. Backtesting proves misleading for alternative commodities, and trend quality, measured by autocorrelation and linked to speculative activity, is increasingly as important as trend quantity. The commodity markets are fracturing, with the noise at the front end offering less reliable signals than the longer-term climate-like trends.
Climate-like trends, so producers and consumers are dictating price discovery, not algorithms.
Traditional market actors inadvertently create systemic distortion by breaking up large trades into smaller executions to minimize slippage, auto-correlating their own actions and obscuring overall market impact. Tom Babbage estimates this costs liquid CTAs 70 to 100 basis points annually. It highlights a key point. The core innovation isn't the AI models themselves, but the agent harness, the orchestration of memory, tool connection, and context management.
Agent harness the plumbing, not the product.
Consider this, anyone can replicate Claude Code's functionality with alternative models once they rebuild that foundational system. Consequently, potential IP leaks diminish in importance, shifting the value proposition towards architecting superior systems around capable models. This is fueling a transition from a marketing to humans phase to a full-blown AI economy, where value derives from tools, skills, and agents utilized by AIs, not direct human consumption.
Isaiah Morales and his genetic business model. A fascinating name for a very unsettling prospect.
It exemplifies the change. And this agent-driven demand is silently reshaping critical infrastructure priorities. The market valuation of banks is undergoing a phased transition, shifting from forward earnings to book value, then to tangible book value, and ultimately to a discount to tangible book value. This reflects growing unease about hidden losses within private credit portfolios.
2008 deja vu.
Very similar dynamics. Regulatory changes post-GFC incentivized a move from traditional bank lending to a shadow lending realm now facing liquidity issues, exacerbating this vulnerability. Assumptions that energy price declines are broadly disinflationary also prove flawed, masking a critical vulnerability in global fertilizer reserves. Less than 30 days of caloric supply remains.
Cheaper electricity doesn't equal cheaper food, and nobody's noticed the looming agricultural crisis.
That's the synthesis.
Saudi Arabia's curtailed oil export capacity establishes a structurally higher oil price baseline. These converging factors miscalibrate current risk pricing across multiple asset classes. The market underestimates the velocity of capital deployed by autonomous agents and the systemic implications of resource constraints.
A polite way of saying things are about to get interesting.
Stepping back, the actions of these agents, prioritizing efficiency regardless of human intentions, will test the balance sheets of even highly rated financial institutions by 2028. Conventional stress scenarios will prove inadequate.
Okay, let's play this out. If I bet against the energy transition, I bet against AI, I bet against the banks, and I accidentally trigger a global famine, what's the worst that could happen? First, my portfolio implodes. Then my social media is canceled. And finally, my artisanal sourdough starter develops sentience and demands reparations.
The emergent behavior of a machine economy, driven by factors outside traditional economic frameworks, dictates future valuation. We're witnessing a fundamental realignment of risk, and current pricing mechanisms are simply not equipped to assess it. We expect substantial volatility across commodity, fixed income, and equity markets as this recalibration unfolds. The question now is, how will we measure value in a world where efficiency rather than earnings is the primary driver?
Looking back at everything this week, the Iranian maneuvers in the Strait, the crypto flows, the AI sprint, the seemingly relentless hacks, it feels less like a collection of discrete events and more like a fundamental resorting of power. It's not about alliances anymore, is it? It's about controlling the plumbing. Alex, you mentioned earlier the idea of infrastructure as a monetizable asset. But it feels bigger than just profit.
Two things stand out. It's the creation of controlled dependencies, and it's happening across multiple layers simultaneously. Think about Iran potentially generating billions from vessel tolls, exceeding the revenue of the canals themselves. That's not just economic leverage, that's geopolitical realignment, forcing a recalibration of trade routes and insurance models. We're seeing the early stages of a parallel system emerging, one that bypasses traditional financial guardrails and frankly doesn't need them. The $3 billion in USDT transactions, the $285 million lost to Drift Protocol, these aren't isolated incidents. They're symptoms of a system built on trust that's rapidly eroding.
And that trust, or the illusion of it, is what fuels everything. You pointed out the paradoxical nature of using established currencies for adversarial activities. It's like we're building a house of cards on a fault line. And with AI accelerating at this pace, 90% jailbreak rates on LLMs, Anthropic's Mythos identifying vulnerabilities decades old, it feels like we're handing the keys to the demolition crew before the foundation is even dry.
It's a telling detail. The value proposition of AI is rapidly shifting. It's less about chatbots and more about autonomous agents operating within a burgeoning AI economy. But as GLM 5.1's jump to 1,700 steps shows, the testing and comprehension lag dramatically behind development. And on top of that, the growing information control capabilities, the export of digital censorship is setting a precedent, a messy normalization of authoritarian practices. It's like a stained glass window being rapidly reassembled, not with beautiful artistry, but with pieces that deliberately obscure the light, creating pockets of shadow.
Speaking of shadows, I kept circling back to Maya's question of just who benefits from all this disruption. The U.S. financial market's projected outperformance feels less like a natural outcome and more like a structural advantage, built on energy independence. But will that advantage be enough to counteract the systemic instability looming by 2028, especially as conventional stress tests become increasingly irrelevant?
That's the critical question. Keep a close eye on sovereign wealth fund announcements in the next 18 months. A partially Hormuz-financed fund will be a very telling sign. Also, monitor stablecoin adoption. That $127 trillion figure isn't just a number. It represents a potential paradigm shift. And finally, look for the first banks to shift their valuations to book value, then tangible book value. That'll signal the beginning of a fundamental reassessment of risk.
Well, we'll be tracking all of that. Until next week, remember this week's throughline. The rules are being rewritten, the infrastructure is shifting, and the question isn't if things will change, but how quickly. And frankly, who's holding the blueprint?